Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. We have a quorum, and we are ready to go. But first, we have the minutes from our previous meeting with Senator Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we do that, I know I've already given you your candy, but happy Valentine's Day. Appreciate that. But I do move the minutes of the February 9th meeting.
The minutes are moved. Is there discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So, members, we have three items on our agenda. We have a bill, House File 975, that we'll be taking up first. And then at that point, we'll revert to an informational hearing with a number of different local government representatives. We'll do that for, you know, roughly 40 minutes or so. And then right around, 9:20 or so, 9:15, 9:20, we'll do House File 4, and then discussion, amendments, et cetera. And if we need to go a couple minutes over time on House File 4, we will, but.
Three.
Past four.
Yeah, that's true. Sorry. Yeah. People are like, yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, we're bringing back House File 4 for first. No, House File 3. Excuse me. House File 3. And then we'll adjourn. So with that, members, I would like to move House File 975, and that is going to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Moeller, welcome back to the Transportation Committee, and tell us all about House File 974. Five. Really, I'm bad. You guys, I've always been bad with numbers. Mr. Mitchell, my math teacher, will tell you. 975.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So some of you who were here last session will remember this bill. This is a bill that was brought to me by Legal Aid, and it has to do with people getting stuff out of their cars. The stuff out of car bills 2.0 is what we call this. But for many Minnesotans who are homeless and destitute and living in their cars, if their car gets towed, it can be more than an inconvenience. It can mean a deprivation of everything that they own. So in 2008, this legislature recognized the interest of both the financially vulnerable Minnesotans and the towing business and struck a compromise that established in law that those who are homeless or otherwise destitute to get their stuff out of their towed cars, even if they don't have the ability to pay for the towing and storage fees. So that was the Stuff in Cars 1.0 bill back in 2008. But this bill is before you this year because what's been happening is some of those, and in spite of the law, some of those indigent owners have been denied access to those items out of their car, things such as medicine and medical equipment. And so creating that right in 2008 without a remedy really didn't solve this problem. And so this bill seeks to solve that problem, and it requires that a tow lot operator who refuses to return an eligible car owner's belongings after the owner presents the documentation, that they have to give that owner a reason why they're refusing compliance. And to ensure that there is a remedy to enforce the right, the bill gives the aggrieved vehicle owner the right to seek an injunction to compel compliance, and if their belongings have been destroyed, to seek compensation. So the bill before you is a compromise bill. We're very pleased that we were able to reach a resolution with the Towing Association. I'm unaware of any opposition to your bill, and you do have a letter in your packet from the Towing Association, and I do have a testifier, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And first, I'd like to thank Representative Moeller so much for carrying this bill for several years and finally, hopefully, get it over the finish line. And I would like to thank the chair for co-authoring and really like to thank Representative Petersburg and Mr. Marble for their help for 2 years in making the case and really having such compassion in their hearts for this bill and for what we're trying to do. I'd also like to thank the Minnesota Professional Towing Association, as Representative Moeller said, with whom we worked, and to arrive at the language before you today. And I'd also like to thank Fagri Drinker, and in particular Attorney Hannah Anderson, who couldn't be here today. But Legal Aid has consulted with and co-counseled with Fagri Drinker on a number of cases that one of the reasons we're here today. And I'd just like to illustrate briefly, just talk about one case that really illustrates exactly why we're here. A client of Ms. Anderson's came to her, sought to retrieve her belongings from her vehicle after she was in an accident. She was eligible under the 2008 law, but she was rebuffed. And Ms. Anderson delivered the required documentation from Legal Aid proving she was eligible to get her stuff out of her car. Not only wasn't she able to get her stuff out of the car, but then the period that is allowable to keep the car expired, and they actually tossed the car and all of her stuff. She lost all of her belongings that were in that car. So Legal Aid receives calls all the time across the state from Minnesotans who have encountered similar violations of that law. This bill is needed, and I urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Are there any questions of either the testifier or the author or committee discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify either in support or opposition to House File 975? Wonderful. Chair Mueller, any closing comments before we vote?
I just want to thank you again, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Petersburg also. It's been a pleasure to work on this bill with you and ask for your support. Thank you.
So thank you very much. Well, members, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 975 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, Chair
Mueller.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Elwood. You're on your way to Judiciary. Okay, members, now we are going to have an informational hearing, and I want to thank Representative Murphy and others. I know Representative Olson's been interested in this, Representative Brand, but it really is of interest to the entire committee. We want to make sure that we get testimony about need as it relates to road and bridge infrastructure throughout the state, and we have many local government partners over many years in this committee. And so one of the main purposes of this informational hearing is to hear from our local government partners and get more information on their situation with road and bridge infrastructure and what they would like to see come out of this session in transportation. So we'll have a couple of presentations and a number of testifiers. And as I said, in about, 35, 40 minutes or so, we'll revert. We'll end this part of the meeting and then go back to bills. And then at that point, we'll hear House File 3. So our first presentation will come from Jeff Krieger. And he'll have a couple of township representatives with him. And Mr. Krieger, thank you very much for your attendance today. And please state your name for the record, and then we'll hear from others in your association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Horst Tornstein. I'm actually by myself today.
Okay.
And so I apologize if you're expecting more.
Well, I think we'll hear from people on Township Day at the Capitol, right?
Yeah, we will definitely hear from more people in the future. I appreciate that. My name is Jeff Krieger. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Townships. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I am here to talk about, obviously, transportation. One of the things I do want to discuss is, with my association, we do represent 1,780 townships. We do have maintain over 55,500 miles of roads, which is the largest, about 41% of all roads in the state of Minnesota. And currently, I think in 2022, we did receive about $51 million in funding from the HUTDF. This year, it is projected to go down. We actually got some new numbers in that. It's projected to go down to about $37 million this year. Last year, we got one-time funding that was appropriated back in 2021 for 2022. And with the HUTDF going down 7%, we're expecting even more of a decrease that way. What we are asking for is a minimum of $40 million in increase for our Minnesota Township roads. And we're agnostic as far as how we get there. I know last year we did talk a lot about auto parts and repair sales tax, but whether we have that or a combination with that and car rentals or tabs, however you want to get there, we're open to that. And we'd be interested in any ideas that you guys have. And along with that, I also do want to talk about truck weight exemptions. We know that there usually are a few bills, and that does have severe impact on our township roads, especially when you're talking 5 to 6 ton roads. And we do want to increase that standard to about 10 ton roads, and with that, that can also help us in accepting more of those truck weight exemptions for those bigger equipment, farm equipment, semis, you name it. Everything is getting huge, and it really is having a dire effect on our roads. And the last thing I just want to talk about was road turnbacks, and we are having issue with some of our counties, and where they're turning back roads, and it's having quite a bad impact on our budgets. And townships just don't have the money or the means to take on those additional roads. I always go back to an instance with my township, with the 14th largest township in the state. We have about $1 million levy. That's it, for the annual spend, and 70% of it goes to roads. In comparison to what we do here in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, they have about 60,000 miles of roads, and they're getting about $168 million in dedicated ongoing funding. And so they're about four times what we're going to be getting here in 2023. And so we just ask if we can up that a bit for us and help us any way that you can. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Krieger. Are there any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was aware that MnDOT sometimes turned back roads to counties, but I was not aware that counties turn back roads to townships.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Did you want to just affirm that?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Yes, counties do have that option. If the roads are considered not to be of regional significance for that county, they will turn back roads occasionally.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you.
Okay. Right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And
thank you, Chair.
We look forward to our continued engagement with you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Rick West. I'm sorry. No, I just wanted to affirm Mr. Krieger, that the others, oh, they're separate. Okay, I'm sorry. Lyndon, we have Lyndon and Grove Gent and Gordy Wagner. Sorry about that. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and names for the record, and we'll proceed with your testimony.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Chair. My name's Lyndon Robgent. I am the Carver County Highway Engineer, and I am representing the Minnesota County Engineers Association and the Association of Minnesota Counties. Just a little bit of background about the county road and bridge system. There are approximately 44,500 miles of county highways in the state. That represents 31% of the total road mileage in Minnesota. Those are designated in two categories, county state aid highways, which makes up about 69%, and county roads that make up the remaining mileage. There is an important distinction between the two categories. As you know, the county state aid highway system is eligible for funding through the HUTDF, whereas the county road system is not. That has to be funded by counties alone. We also have approximately 8,200 bridges in the state, and that represents 41% of the total in Minnesota. So I think, Mr. Chair, you do have some handouts that represent our slides as well. Some traditional county funding sources, real quick. The HUTDF is by far the most important fund to the counties. The counties get 29% of 95% of that revenue. County boards can enact a wheelage tax up to $20 per vehicle. They can also enact a local option sales tax up to 0.5% on retail in their county. We compete for federal funds through the IIJA. I know there's been a lot of talk about IIJA and the impact to locals. Those are competitive through the MPOs and ATPs. We rely heavily on the state bonding program, whether that's for local bridges, the local road improvement program, as well as the local road wetland replacement program. Counties, of course, also levy property tax for county roads and bridges, as well as maintaining the system and operating the county highway departments. And on occasion, counties do sell bonds to do high priority projects. Snapshot of the current HUTDF, you can see there's approximately $2.6 billion in 2023 from the fuel tax, license tab fees, motor vehicle sales tax, and the sales tax on auto part repair parts and rental sales tax. Of that, approximately $686 million goes to counties. Of note, that is a reduction from last year. Last year's appropriation was $704 million. Wheelage tax, currently 55 counties have adopted the wheelage tax. Our research in 2020, that generated about $54 million, or about $1 million per county. That can be used for transportation purposes, including CASAs, county roads, and even buildings for county highway departments. The local option sales tax, county boards can enact up to 0.5% on retail sales within the county. That can be used for specific transportation projects, as well as transit capital and operating costs. To date, 55 counties have adopted the sales tax that generated about $420 million in 2021. Of note, $260 million of that revenue is the eight metro counties with 161 outstate. Further note, Hennepin and Ramsey generates about $184 million, and I'd have to say the majority of those funds go to transitways in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. The suburban counties in the metro area use it for road and bridges as well as transit. One brief comment on that, too, is counties in the metro, the suburban counties also invest a large percentage of the local option sales tax on locally led trunk highway projects. Mm-hmm. So we're helping out the state on high priority projects in our counties. IIJA, as you know, there's been a big increase from the FAST Act through the formula funds, about a 33% increase. 70% goes to MnDOT, 30% to locals. Those are competitive through the ATPs. About 155 goes to the metro area, $101 million per year to Greater Minnesota. An additional 24 is a statewide competitive process. We've identified for local county road and bridge projects, there is about a $30 million per year local match requirement. So even though the fund has increased, there is a burden on the locals to provide the local match for these projects. The Local Road Improvement Program, this is a grant process administered through the Office of State Aid at MnDOT. Again, a really great program because it serves cities, counties, and townships to construct or reconstruct local roads. The last time there was a solicitation for this competitive process was in 2020, and you can see there was 425 applicants requesting $344 million. About in 2020 and 2021, about $80 million was awarded. So there is an unfunded gap there of over $260 million on the local road system. The Local Bridge Replacement Program, again, this is another state bonding program, which is extremely important to the locals. As you can see, there are approximately 959 bridges on the five-year waiting list. 586 of those are county bridges, and we have a need of about $290 million of funds through the Local Bridge Replacement Program. Extremely efficient program. It's a first-come, first-serve. If your bridge meets the replacement eligibility, you do a design, you get on the list. And the counties have skin in the game. The majority of county bridges are funded at 50%. So counties put in about half the money. The overall funding needs for counties, we don't have a statewide plan really that shows our big overall need into the future. We do rely on the old TFAC report from 2012 that showed about a $900 million per year gap on the county highway systems. We do have a computer program called the CASA Need Study, which looks at the life cycle costs to replace our current roads in kind over a 60-year life. That shows about an $800 million per year need for the CASA system, and then we've prorated that to the county roads to add another $360. Available through the HUTDF, there is about $420 million a year. If you remember, Mr. Chair, 60% of the CASA funds goes to construction, 40% goes to maintenance and operating. So we have a gap of about $378 million on the CASA system and $250 million on the county road system. If you assume that we get approximately $150 million a year from the IIJA, we've calculated a total gap of close to $480 million per year. And inflation has grown that number tremendously.
Jen, if you could, this inflation is very important. I know you have several slides on that, but if you could just wrap up because we have at least
sure.
One question.
Yes. So, yeah, running through the inflation, our current bread and butter projects, whether it's roads, bridges, we've seen a tremendous increase in cost. An example here is on concrete box culverts. A 50% increase in 1 year. We build about 100 of these a year, and there's also a supply issue. We're waiting 9 months to get the materials. Bridges have seen a 25% cost increase in 2 years. Traffic signals, there's a lot of those in the metropolitan area. Those have gone up 31% in 2 years, so dramatic numbers. And from the operation side, equipment costs have increased tremendously. We're having a big winter this year. The cost of a snowplow is now $340,000, whereas it was $260,000 in 2020. So our funding request is to increase the sustainable funding through the HUTDF, whether that's through the motor fuel tax, registration fees, motor vehicle sales tax, and charges on electric vehicles. We request that 100% of the sales tax on auto parts repair be dedicated to transportation. We are requesting a general fund appropriation to the CASA fund for our revenue loss and the IIJ local match. We are requesting a robust bonding bill for local bridges and roads, as well as for the local road wetland replacement program. So we could put some samples of the potential revenue sources per fund here, Mr. Chair, and I won't run through those, but we've included how much a 5-cent fuel tax increase would generate, the governor's proposal for tab fees, increasing the motor vehicle sales tax, and the new retail delivery fee proposal would be beneficial to us as well. Also, the sales tax on auto parts, if we get 100% dedicated through the HUTDF, that would increase the county share by $50 million. We know there's some proposals for alternatives on that, which we support. If small cities, townships, transit, and need funding as well, we have a proposal with a percentage of a direct appropriations to county on a new formula. The request for general fund appropriation, again, this is an inflationary impact. The HUTDF for counties has gone down by $17 million in 1 year. If you add inflation, we have a request for about $26 million one-time appropriation to make us whole, and then an IIJ local match appropriation of $30 million per year for those federal projects. Bonding, we're requesting $200 million for bridges and $200 million for roadways, as well as $17 million for the local road wetland replacement program. We also think it's important that there's a base funding through the budget for the local road wetland replacement program, and we're requesting an annual budget of $7 million to make that a sustainable fund. That's all I got. I know a lot of information, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I really appreciate this. This is exactly the kind of information that we were hoping that we could get today. So a well-organized and excellent presentation. Two quick questions from Chair Cagle and then Representative Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if you are tracking the number of IIJA grants applied versus awarded. If you have those numbers, I'd love to see them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, I don't. I know that counties apply for a lot of locally led trunk highway projects as well as main street type projects, but I don't have the number that have been applied by locals, but it's considerable and it's growing, but I can get you that information.
Thank you. And I just also just want to know how many have been awarded, because I believe when you testified in my committee, you applied 12 times for a grant. And so I just want to know if our efforts are being successful and how we can help.
Yes, good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cagle. Yes, on a Highway 212 project in Carver County, which is a trunk highway led by the county, we applied for 12 times for DOT discretionary grants, and we finally were awarded $10 million in an infra grant. So it's a tremendous effort. Each grant application costs between $30,000 and $40,000.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you. So the one thing that is not in here is how much property tax money are counties putting into their transportation systems?
That's a really good question, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins, I don't know that number per county, but I would have to say to run our offices, you have to pay salaries, buy equipment, buy materials. We put in, as Carver County, we put in $3 million of property tax for construction. Yep. And about $9 million to run our operations.
Yeah. Is this something that the counties could compile?
Yes, I think so.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we have Commissioner Wagner.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gordy Wagner. I've been a Polk County Commissioner for 15 years and currently serve as the chair of the Association of Minnesota Counties Transportation Policy Committee. Polk County is also a member of Minnesota Rural Counties. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you a rural local perspective on transportation funding needs. Adequate, dedicated annual funding through the HUTDF is critical and of the highest priorities for counties and particularly rural counties like mine, without major population centers and less population density such as mine. The ability to leverage local option wheelage fees and sales taxes for transportation are appreciated, but do very little for Polk County and low population areas who still have important roads and bridges that must be constructed and maintained. Using statewide formula funding through HUTDF provides greater equity throughout the state. Polk County, AMC, and MRC are open to any forms of dedicated highway funding, whether through increases in existing revenue streams, dedication of existing taxes, such as auto parts sales tax, or new sources of revenue, such as delivery fees, as proposed by Representative of Cagle. Bonding programs are important funding supplements for cities and counties, as is federal program funding. However, all of these sources are less consistent, more difficult to plan for, and do not consistently provide funding to all road authorities like dedicated funding through HUTDF. Rural counties such as Polk County also recognize the importance of the state's transit systems. Polk County is one of six counties within Rainbow Rider Rural Transit System in western Minnesota. As our population continues to age, it is also important to adequately fund our rural transit systems to continue to provide rides to the disadvantaged and elderly. They also provide meals on wheels to those who are homebound. In rural Minnesota, transit isn't possible without also adequately maintaining the road and bridge system. Therefore, efforts should be made to adequately fund roads, bridges, and transit while not taking from one to fund another. Thank you once again for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much, Commissioner, and thank you to the AMC for all of your partnership over so many years. Questions?
Thank you.
Okay, members, we're now going to hear some additional testimony, and I would just ask the testifiers, with the exception of Rick West, who came down all the way from Otter Tail County, to stay within the prescribed limits of the conversation you had with our committee administrator. So, our first testifier is Rick West. I want to thank Representative Murphy for arranging. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rick West. I'm the retired Otter Tail County engineer, served Otter Tail County for over 30 years. And as you can see this morning, I'm failing at retirement, but that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'll keep my comments brief this morning in the interest of time. Just wanted to spend some time with the committee this morning to talk a little bit about Otter Tail County. In 2015, Otter Tail County adopted its very first long-range strategic transportation program, or plan. It was titled Otter Tail County 2040 Transportation Plan, which took a look at our system out to the year 2040. That plan was recently updated in 2022, and with the update, we've updated the numbers in the plan, our projections for pavement quality, which I'll get to in a bit. Otter Tail County, through the initial planning process, we have instituted the local option sales tax in Otter Tail County and also the wheelage tax to supplement our needed funding. As we look at our system in 2022, I believe the committee has handouts available to them. The first one I would just refer to is a map of our tiered preservation system, which was an outcome of our planning effort in 2015. But looking at our system, we have a large system, about 1,068 miles of county highway. And we began looking at how are we going to preserve our system. We devised a tiered program, much like the Olympics, I guess, where we have different colors. We're platinum, gold, silver, and bronze. And the platinum routes, of course, are our backbone of our system, our 10-ton system. We moved down the color chart, gold, silver, bronze. Bronze is basically local roads, lower traffic volumes, local access. Currently, with our funding, the platinum and the gold routes are the routes that are receiving the bulk of the funding. The bronze routes, I would suspect over time, we'll see very little contract work such as overlays, et cetera, for maintenance will be maintained by our maintenance crews. The other portion of the handout is the 2022 financial gap analysis, which is at the upper, it's a bar chart in the upper half of the document. Basically, we're looking at from 2023 on through the end of our plan, 2040, on average, we're estimating an $18 million funding gap per year over the life of our current plan. The lower half of the handout shows current year pavement condition on the left-hand side. We look on the right-hand side, we're looking at projected pavement condition in the year 2040. And I think, Mr. Chair, member, that really illustrates what our system is going to look like in the year 2040, which is not that far away. Example, the gold route today, we've had a rating of 70 for a pavement quality index. If we take it out to 2040, we've got a rating of 51. So it illustrates with increased funding, we haven't solved our problems, but we've slowed the decline in the condition of our system, which I think illustrates, I think, the need for long-term, sustainable, dedicated funding for transportation, whether you're state level, local level, county, city, townships. And one of my...
if you could wrap up, actually point is very well taken and
yeah.
one of our main themes, and yep. of course pavement quality too. So we could wrap up because we have a few more testifiers
yep.
we'd like to get.
My closing remark is a saying of that Rick West said many times over career in Otterdale County. Take a good look at our highways today because they're the best condition you will see them in. And that wasn't always popular, but the plan bears out. That's a true statement.
Representative Murphy, thank you.
Thank you, committee chair.
The most compelling testimony from a county engineer I've heard in many years. So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. West. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Just a little bit about Mr. West. He's a bit of a celebrity in Otterdale County. I represent Otterdale County. And Mr. West is a national winner of a county engineer of the year. And so he's an expert in his 30 years here. The one thing that caught me the last time we talked is that you talked about how these roads were, and you just finished with it in your conclusion. Is there a chance that some of our roads will actually have to revert back, let's say from a tar road to a gravel road in some conditions? Because we're not able to keep up, and we are falling greatly behind. Do you see that as a possibility?
The answer to the question, Representative, I do. When you look at our system, the bronze level, which is about 135 miles or so, there is that definite possibility that some of those roads will revert to gravel. And once that happens, you know, that's a very serious discussion to have, but once that reverts to gravel, there's very little chance they'll ever come back to a paved surface, in my opinion.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay. Yep. Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sadly for me, there is no relation.
Very good. Well, thank you. You know, we appreciate your coming down and your testimony and all of your service, and we're glad you took some time out of your retirement.
Yeah, well, Otterdale County appreciates the opportunity. Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you. Members, I'm going to extend this portion of the hearing till 9:25 just because we have some people, especially that came from out of town. And we want to make sure, I'm going to take them first in case we do run out of time. And so that would, first we have Bill McCabe from St. Augusta. And again, our purpose here is for folks to clearly and quickly tell us your needs and get those on the record. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bill McCabe. I'm the city administrator of St. Augusta, and I'm also a board member of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. As most of you are aware, Minnesota cities under 5,000 receive zero dedicated funding, and that is an issue with cities, especially the size of St. Augusta, who have 66 miles of road to maintain. The intermittent funding that we've gotten over the past 10 years has averaged about $7,000 a year, and that almost helps with pothole filling. But it's needed to be more, and it needs to be ongoing and dedicated. The lack of dedicating funding makes it almost impossible for communities our size and others to plan for how to best use these dollars. Instead, cities see small additional payments when we receive LGA, and that money is to offset existing transportation spending already in the works. Ideally, we would be able to plan and set aside some dollars for larger projects we know are needed in the future. In St. Augusta, we have a road, condition map, and we know exactly where and when that funding will be necessary, and our cities do not have the same revenue options other cities to fund that, and so with dedicated funding, that's all we're asking for, is dedicated funding to keep our streets maintained and provide the needed services we have.
Thank you so much, and we do appreciate you know, our partnership with Small Cities, and you've been saying that for a very long time, and it's really one of my goals that we're going to finally get that done this year, but we'll need some revenue. Mr. O'Rourke, did you have some quick
comments, Mr. Chair? And members, my name is Cap O'Rourke. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Association of Small Cities. There are over 700 cities with populations under 5,000. I believe as of today we will add that number by one. As the city of Empire will join the ranks of small cities. These cities are the only local municipality to get zero dedicated funding from the state. At one point, there was an iteration of LGA that accounted for lack of transportation funding that was taken out a number of years ago. And since then, we have the Small Cities Assistance Formula, which is a formula that works well when it is funded. Unfortunately, over the last 10 years, it has intermittent funding. And as Mr. McCabe said, this has equaled about $7,000 per year over the course of this funding for our small cities. What we are asking for is ongoing dedicated funding of at least $30 million per year that grows. Not only will this help and maintain the over 12,000 miles that exist in small cities, as Mr. McCabe said, it'll also allow these councils to plan to use some money for one-time projects and ongoing, but also set aside money for the project that they see coming down the road. And often these are projects that are coming from state or county refits of local roads, and they are required to do their local match. So having dedicated funding is critical. We have not, there's no legislator that has been opposed to this. Unfortunately, in the transportation world, it is often considered to be the cherry on top of the sundae when we get global agreement. We have yet to get global agreement, and we have been sitting on the sidelines for far too long. It's time to give small cities some dedicated revenue.
Thank you very much for your work, and we look forward to, you know, maintaining our contact over the rest of this session. Next, we have Deborah Heiser from St. Louis Park, and but also involved with the City Engineers Association. So we've got a couple of members. We've had Representative Murphy, and now Representative Kraft having their locals appear before us, and we appreciate that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Deb Heiser, and I am the engineering director for St. Louis Park, which is a suburb first just to the west of Minneapolis. I'm also the secretary treasurer for the City Engineers Association of Minnesota. I just really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about something that is just near and dear to my heart, transportation funding. Every Minnesotan relies on transportation to meet their physical, social, and economic needs. To meet these needs, we need adequate, stable sources of funding to ensure that we can construct and maintain a transportation system that is efficient and safe. Property taxes, special assessments, and our HUTDF, which is MSA for us, you heard CASA from the counties, they just aren't keeping up. Let me tell you how this impacts my city. We have 130 miles of street. 33 miles of those are on the municipal state aid system. They're regional. They carry between 3,000 and 20,000 vehicles a day. Most of our system's at the end of its service life. Routine maintenance isn't enough. We have $101 million in reconstruction needs for those municipal state aid roads. For every $1,000 in needs, we get $10.79. That's 1%. This year, we got $1.4 million. We have 23 million needs in the next 10 years. We're only getting $14 million. How do we fill that gap? Keep in mind now, these costs are just to reconstruct the roads. These roads were built over 50 years ago and are built around the car. These roadways not only need reconstruction, they need modernization. LED lighting, roundabouts, safe pedestrian crossings, bikeways, sidewalks, trails. When you look at, you know, how people get around, it's going to be different. We ask that you to support the sufficient statewide transportation funding for all modes of travel and local control to serve long-term needs. Here's our asks. We need more tools like the Street Improvement District. We can establish funds to reconstruct our utilities based on usage. Why not have it for streets? We need stability and an increase in revenue for the HUTDF. IIJA is an amazing opportunity. We need matching funds. We need help for writing grants for small cities. Finally, we ask for robust bonding. We've been talking about the Local Road Improvement Fund, the Local Bridge Replacement Program. These are critical. The city of St. Louis Park got local bridge replacement fund dollars to replace a bridge down by the hospital, a critical piece of infrastructure. So with that, I really appreciate your time this morning. If you have questions, please let me know.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to just go a little, we're going to get a make sure we get a couple of the folks that are not here with us usually every day and from out of town in case we run short of time here. We'll have first Tony Klodek, the city administrator from Rushford. It's come a long way, so we appreciate that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Tony Klodek. I'm the city administrator in Rushford, and I'm on here on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. I've testified in the past on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and I sit on the chair of the Southeastern League of Minnesota Cities. I'm here to primarily to testify on behalf of dedicated funding for the small cities business, small cities aid assistance program. We know in my city of 1,860 population that those funds come in helpful. They've been intermittent, however, and we're looking for a dedicated formula. You've heard from the counties and the townships and things like that. There's a dedicated formula, but there isn't one for cities under 5,000, and we're one of them. And we definitely would appreciate further consideration of that. I'm not going to reiterate all the points that have been made already, but the city of Rushford, down in the southeastern corner of the state, or whether you're one of the other 700 cities that are under 5,000 population, I'm sure we all speak for those folks. It would be nice to have reliable funding to help us pave our streets and maintain our streets. You live in some of those cities. You go to some of those cities. Your neighbors go to some of those cities. We have tourists that come in and use our streets. They buy gas. They get maintenance. They buy vehicles. So our residents send funds up this way, and we're looking for the state to contribute a little bit to the small cities of this state as well. And I don't have any more to add to that. I just very much appreciate that this has been an emphasis, and we've talked about this in a number of groups that it's getting more attention, and I hope we see it through.
You have our attention, and we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and we'll next we'll have Wayne Sandberg, who has also been a partner over the years from Washington County. Oh, okay. Sorry to hear that. We'll hopefully hear from him again. So our last two folks who have signed up are Shane Zart and Steve Novak. Maybe if you all want to come up together and we can expedite time. Mr. Zart, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Shane Zart. I'm with the firm Flaherty and Hood and representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which is a group of more than 110 cities outside of the seven-county metro area. And in part, just wanted to say ditto to the messages you've already heard. Don't need to repeat everything they said, but on both small cities and for MSA cities, the needs are great. And for those small cities in particular, also want to lift up the letter that was submitted by the city of Slayton. Couldn't be here today, but they've got a pretty dramatic written testimony on some of the funding options or lack of funding options a small city has when they're facing a major expenditure and don't have state funds that they can rely on to build toward that expenditure. So, but because those have been covered, I want to use the balance of my brief testimony here to address something that hasn't been come up, and that's the Corridors of Commerce program. And not because it's one of the programs that provides money directly to our communities, but because it's made great strides in funding major projects that connect our communities, both in the metro and in greater Minnesota. Highways like 14, 23, it used to be that Highway 14, you couldn't go a transportation committee hearing without at least three or four mentions of Highway 14. And Representative Brand, Representative Petersburg, we don't hear about it so much anymore. And part of the reason is Corridors of Commerce helped get a major stretch done. There's construction going on in Representative Brand's district right now to finish a 12-mile stretch, hopefully by this October. But that program, since about 2018, has frankly kind of lost the trust of advocates of the Department of Transportation. MnDOT, not to speak for them, but I think they'd be comfortable with me saying this, they had some issues with the inefficiencies in the program and how it was administered or how they were required to administer it in the 2018 grant round. A lot of the advocates had some trouble with even the geographic balance of the projects that were selected. The underlying program is still as it was, still today as it was then. The House in your omnibus bill last year had what we thought was a pretty artful proposal. No proposal is perfect, but this one did a really good job of balancing interests, addressing many of the administration's concerns, a pretty creative look at how to approach geographic balance going forward. Well, I think and I know that proposal is coming back. I don't know where it is in terms of jackets or coming back out of the reviser's office, but I can leave it there because hopefully it's not the last time I'm sitting here talking about this and that bill will come forward too. But thank you very much.
Thank you. So yeah. Next time members you see Representative Torkelson, tell him he's artful. So, our last testifier, thank you so much for hanging in there with us, is Steve Novak, a longtime transportation advocate as well, and former state senator. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I believe that a copy of our platform was sent electronically to the committee. If not, I do have hard copies here. Let me get right to it. If you have that document, you'll see at the top of the first page we've got four or five top priorities, and I just want to touch on those. And as I do that, I want to try to reflect what's already going on. This session has gotten off to a fast start, and it's moving right along. But one of our top priorities, which we want to say thank you for already, is provide state appropriations to fund the federal IIJA match requirements. Both houses got off to a fast start on that bill, and things look very good for that. And we would view that to be, Mr. Chairman, a comprehensive approach. I know you like to use that term in terms of the bill you're trying to build, so I'll piggyback on it and use it also. For bullet number one, thank you, comprehensive approach. On the second bullet, appropriate $200 million in bonds for the bridge replacement program and $250 million for local road improvement program and grants. As was mentioned by Lyndon earlier, that's a fundamental program for county governments around the state. I think most of you know because you've become transportation experts, but the County Road and Bridge Program is larger than the State Highway Program. But how we get funds to it follows narrow paths along the way, as we'll see once again this year. So we believe, based on the need, based on the documented projects that are in front of MnDOT in coordination with the counties, that the numbers we have in here, $200 million, and $250 million actually wouldn't quite meet the total need, but would go a long ways towards doing that. So as we look at what's on the table right now, the governor has $125 million and $100 million for bridges. You know, that's pretty comprehensive. The House yesterday put $85 and roughly $60 million on the table, and that's meaningful, and we appreciate that and say thanks. One of the open questions is whether or not cash will be added to that, and we know that that part of the process is still coming, but we want to point out the importance of this program. The third point, bullet point, is established base funding for the local road wetland replacement program. Our platform pegs it just about exactly where the governor has it in his proposal, $18 million in bonds, $7 million in cash. So far, the House proposal as of yesterday was $12 million in bonds, which, again, we call that meaningful. We say thanks. But as we look for comprehensive, Mr. Chairman, maybe some cash and other things can come along the way to complete that cycle. Bullet number four is retain the distribution of the proceeds from the sales tax on leased vehicles, actually established in 2008 and modified in 2017. That is a very important program for our membership. There's been an ongoing discussion of that probably for about a decade now. That discussion seems to be heating up this year, so we expect, in fact, conversations have started I think, on a very positive front. But we look forward to continuing to visit with you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee about that very important program and how it might be modified to help everyone. And then the last point, Mr. Chairman, is we do support the transfer of the sales tax on auto parts. And like a lot of people, we have suggestions for you on how you might want to spend that money and look forward to talking with you about it. And then I will conclude and say thank you.
I appreciate that, and we look forward to our, again, continued conversation. So, members, we're right on time here. And, again, I want to thank all the testifiers from our local government partners. This is very, very important testimony to help guide us. I want to thank everyone for their specifics in terms of identifying needs. And that's good timing in terms of where we're at in the session to have this hearing. And thank you again, Representative Murphy. We will spend the balance of our time, members, on House File 3. That's House File 3. And Representative Greenman is with us, and I'd like to invite her up. The motion is going to be that House File 3 be recommended for re-referral to the Public Safety Finance and Policy. We're going to Public Safety from here. And let's start here, Representative Greenman, with a big Transportation Committee welcome, Chair Greenman. And we wanted to start with A-12, your two author's amendments to get the bill in the shape you'd like us to consider it in. So with that, let's dig right into your amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it is wonderful to be in transportation, my first time this session. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. Mr. Chair, did you move the A-12?
Yeah. Did you want to? I'll move it, and then you can describe it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A-12 amendment is an author's amendment that incorporates feedback that we got from previous committees and clarifying language adopted in the Senate, defining the declination period when the notice is mailed rather than when the applicant is submitted, allowing the state demographer to determine the three most commonly spoken languages for the language access provision that was discussed in the last committee, and clarifying that parties injured under the voter harassment provisions have a right of action. And the rest of it is mostly just clarifying language to clean up the statute.
Incorporate now the A-12. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails. Members, I will now move the A-13 amendment. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A-13 is a technical amendment offered by Transportation Committee staff that just came in a little late after we had done the amendment. I'm happy to have nonpartisan staff explain the amendment if they'd like.
Mr. Chair and members, the A-13 amendment adds a cross-reference to the main statutory list of what goes into a driver's license application and removes some redundant language. There is a definition already for what kinds of credentials are included in the voter registration.
Thank you for catching that. We rely on Mr. Burris to do that, and he does a great job. Discussion. Okay, all those in favor of the A-13 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails. So we have House File 3 as amended before us. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm really grateful to be here this morning to talk about the Democracy for the People Act. The bill is a comprehensive legislation that invests, protects, and strengthens Minnesota's best traditions of voter participation, sound elections administration, and grassroots people-powered democracy. We heard and discussed the full bill in Elections Committee, and it has many stops, so many of you will hear this bill a couple of times. So I want to, for this committee, to confine my remarks to the part of the bill under the jurisdiction of the Transportation Committee, namely modernizing our voter registration system to include automatic voter registration when eligible Minnesotans apply for a driver's license or a D card. This common sense policy removes barriers to voter registration for eligible voters by changing the default from not registered to registered and ensuring that every eligible voter who wishes to can participate in our democracy. Voter registration in this country has long been a barrier to voter participation. In Minnesota, we have a proud and long-standing tradition of working to remove those barriers. As one of the first states in the nation to implement same-day registration, Minnesota was on the forefront of expanding access to the ballot. But nearly 50 years later, our system is in need of modernization and still leaves too many eligible Minnesotans out. According to the Census Career Population Survey, non-registered eligible voters are likely to be younger, less educated, and more likely to be BIPOC than registered voters. And administrative barriers like voter registration are unnecessary hurdles to participation in our democracy. Nearly half a century later, we have the opportunity to take the next step to modernizing our system to ensure that the voter rolls reflect Minnesota's citizenry and to ensure our system is safe, secure, and accessible. With this modernization, Minnesotans can improve our system, the efficiency, the accuracy, and security of our voter rolls. Here's how it works. When an eligible Minnesotan applies for a license or ID and provides the agency with the information they need to make sure that they're eligible, their address, their age, and proof of citizenship, DPS will securely transmit an applicant's information to the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State will run the same verification text they do with registrants, and then voters will get a postcard alerting them of their eligibility and offering them the opportunity to decline registration if they wish. After that 20-day opt-out period, eligible voters will be added to the registration rolls if they don't decline registration. And any time after that, if folks wish to cancel their registration, they can simply do so. It works the same way for registered voters who are updating their registration with a new address. If you're moving, they'll be mailed a notice that their address will be updated and offered the opportunity to decline that update if they want to. This modernization expands access to voter registration and improves the efficiency, the accuracy, and the security of our system. As a voting rights lawyer who's worked on voting and democracy policy across the country, I can tell you this is a good reform that strengthens access and security. And that's why it's been enacted in red states and blue states, Alaska, Colorado, Oregon, and 19 other states. This bill strengthens the freedom to vote. It makes registration a bridge rather than a barrier to participating in our democracy, and I think we have a few testifiers to talk about it and why it's important. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you very much. And members, just remember, we can go till 10:05, and I want to make sure that folks are aware of that in planning your day. Let's go to the public testimony, and then we'll get to member questions and amendments. Our first testifier is our Secretary of State is here. Secretary of State Simon, welcome to the committee. You've spent many hours in room 200 when you were in the state legislature, so welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. It's great to be with you today, and particularly great to be here given the substance of this bill. Obviously, House File 3 is before you on narrow grounds, and I'm going to focus my remarks on those narrow grounds, which is the automatic voter registration provision. Automatic voter registration is a bipartisan reform. It is a cost-saving measure that will allow us to add or update, we believe, up to 450,000 additional registrations each year. And I think it's important at the outset to remember that the term automatic voter registration is somewhat of a misnomer. I wish this reform went by another name. I've said that for years. It's really more like automated voter registration. There's nothing particularly automatic about it. I think when people hear that term, they justifiably and reasonably think, wait, what's happening automatically here? Are there no human beings involved? No, there are still human beings involved top to bottom, not just with the Division of Vehicle Services, but also with our 87 county partners across the state. They will still be reviewing actual human beings, reviewing and processing the registrations. The registrations will still go through the same state and federally required checks. Human beings do that as well. And I think this is a key point on automatic voter registration. It expands the pool of registrations, but all of the safeguards to our current process remain. The other thing that this will do from a practical standpoint, it will substantially reduce the number of people who avail themselves of election day or same day voter registration. I just want to say out loud what some of you may be thinking. I understand, though I think, that Election Day registrations, as Representative Greenman said, is the jewel in the crown. It is a cornerstone of the system. We've had it since 1973. We were one of the first and earliest adopters of that system, and so it is absolutely essential. But I understand, as a practical standpoint, in this building and perhaps on this committee, there are people who have some misgivings about same day or Election Day registration. There are hundreds of thousands of people every Election Day on Election Day who avail themselves of that. I think the last statistic was 235,000 people. So this is not a niche boutique kind of service. A lot of Minnesotans use this. But if and when this bill is enacted into law, far fewer of them will need to use same day or Election Day voter registration. Why? Because they'll already have been in the system weeks and in many cases many months before Election Day. And I think that is, all in all, a pretty good thing. It means you have people in the system earlier, so that the filtering and the screening can be done earlier by actual human beings. So we also know that getting voters registered before Election Day has already been shown to improve the polling place experience for voters and election judges. We lead the nation in elections, and the availability of Election Day registration is an important part of this. And while this process is vital for voter access, it is the most complex process that our 30,000 election judges have to administer. It can lead to some glitches or some lines in the polling place. And so to get as many voters registered prior to Election Day will make Election Day run more smoothly. I would just say this is a reform, as I said at the outset, that is nonpartisan in origin and nonpartisan in effect. Red states, blue states, and all states in between have implemented some version of automatic voter registration. It modernizes and further refines our voting rolls, and I urge your support. I have to leave this committee hearing, but well, Julie Strother, our Deputy Secretary of State.
If you could hang just 1 second, I wanted to make sure Representative Petersburg was able to
answer. Sure. Of course.
Representative Petersburg.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Secretary, for being here. Just a quick question. The author of the bill has talked about how the process for this to present for being automatically registered while you're driving, get your driver's license, seems like it's at least the same or maybe even more onerous than same day registration. So how is that more equitable, or is that easier for people to register when they could do the same thing during same day registration? It seems like you're providing extra work for people who just want to come in and renew their driver's license.
Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. Good question. I'm not sure I see it that way, and maybe we're just looking at it from a different angle. I don't see it as more onerous. I see it as the same kind of thing that could be done at the polling place. You're right, it could be, and it could be even after this is enacted into law, can be done in one fell swoop with someone's interaction with government. And the reason it's so efficiently done, particularly at DBS, is because the same information that a person has to provide to get or renew a driver's license is typically the very same information that you need to provide to register to vote. And really, when you think about it, what is registering to vote? What is that? What does that term even mean? It really means two things. You have to make some showing that you are who you say you are and that you live where you say you live. That's it. That's all voter registration is. And it just so happens that those are the same requirements for a driver's license, for example. There are other interactions with government for which that's also true, but certainly DVS, that's true. You have to show that you are who you say you are and you live where you say you live. And that's why, at least in my judgment, it's a good, it's a win-win. You're getting the same thing done. It's a sort of a one-stop shop situation. But I don't disagree with what you're saying, Representative, that it could also be done on Election Day. That is true.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I'll let him go. I think we'll have more discussion later, but it just seems like you're also presenting your driver's license, that same information on same day registration, and so it's just a question. We'll debate it later. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I would just say, unfortunately, I do have to go, but I am happy to make myself available in the future to any committee member offline who wants to have this discussion. But in my place is the real brains of the operation, Deputy Secretary of State Julie Strother, who is happy to answer questions in my absence. So thank you.
Well, we will thank you very much. We'll
thank
keep
you,
that in mind. Representative Greenman, I think there are a couple of testifiers. We really need them to keep their testimony brief if they're able to. And, first, we have Stephanie Stasel and then Paul Huffman. Welcome to the committee. Please State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Stephanie Stasel. I live in St. Paul. I'm a leader in Isaiah, and I'm also an election judge for Ramsey County. I'm asking for your support of House File 3, especially for the automatic registration of voters, for several reasons. In my experience as an election judge, there are many new voters that come to the polls to register without the correct documents. We then need to inform them what they need. They need to go home, collect the correct documents, and come back. Sometimes people come in after work, later in the evening, and some have not had time to go home, get the documents, come back, register in time to vote. If people were automatically registered, this would be avoided, and people would know that they would be able to vote when they come to the polls. Secondly, having voters automatically registered was, as Secretary of State Simon said, reduce lines at the polling place, and it does take quite a long time to register at the polling place, so that time would be reduced at the polling place. Finally, I believe that automatic voter registration would encourage young voters to develop a lifelong habit of voting in every election. Thank you for your support of House File 3.
Thank you so much for your work and your testimony. Next, we have Paul Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Paul Huffman. I'm testifying today based on my experience as a head election judge over the last 3 years in four different precincts in Washington counties. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of League of Women Voters Minnesota and of the State Voter Service Chair for that organization. I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of automatic voter registration. In my experience as a head election judge in suburban, rural, more urban precincts, I find in all of them a large number of voters having to register on election day. This has varied anywhere from 3 to 10% of those voting on election day. By and large, the single most common document used is driver's licenses. And the same thing that we're talking about having for automatic voter registration is using that driver's license as the tool to have people registered. The benefit of doing that is to take some of that effort off of county election officials. What we find is that the documents used, if people have to register with a hard copy, it introduces some errors that are then a slight challenge to election judges to sort through an election day. This will reduce those administrative errors that have to be identified and corrected. In addition, that verification of eligibility happens in advance of election day, and now doesn't have to be done after election by county officials, and therefore improves their process and provides greater control of their workload. So since this is already using something that we have readily available, it automates it, it's done ahead of time, it reduces that workload on election judges, which we like doing election day registration, but it is time consuming and complex at times. This will be an improvement for us in the polling places, and includes the accuracy of voter rolls, reducing those election administrations, and it'll increase confidence in the integrity and accuracy of our elections. So based on all of that, I appreciate your support of House File 3 for automatic voter registration. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Huffman. Representative Olson.
Thank you. This is a question for the testifier.
Turn back. And then we'll also have an opportunity to question the author as well.
Perfect. Thank you. So you said that driver's licenses are the main identification that people utilize when they're registering to vote. Can you explain how that goes? Like, I walk in, I say, hi, I'm here to register to vote. Here is my identification. Can you explain to me what you do next?
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Here's the process. You know, somebody says, and most likely what happens is they come in and say, I'm here to vote. And you look at the poll pad, which we use, and their name isn't there. And so for whatever reason, they're not registered. So then we say, okay, now we need to register you. Give me your driver's license. They give us their driver's license. We use it, we scan what's the information on the barcode in the back of driver's license. It will pull up that information from the license in the state system. And we can then go through a process of verifying your address is in the precinct and verifying their information. We look at the picture. We look at that information. And we then print out a sheet they have to read and sign that says things such as, you know, that they're a citizen, they've resided for greater than 20 days, and their current residence is on their driver's license, that they are not a felon who's currently on parole or probation, they're not under any court order. They go and they sign all of that to attest to their eligibility to vote. At that point, we will then, as an election judge, review that, sign it off, and they become registered. We will then allow them to vote. So that's the process.
A real quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you do the barcode. Would that barcode identify whether someone is or is not eligible to vote?
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, they don't. It doesn't say that. It's, you know, those are things that they have to attest to because there's no system that tracks that currently for the state as far as I know.
So this is just the old Boy Scout on my honor, I'll do my duty?
That is correct. And that's
okay. Any further questions? Right. Thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that what you're getting at is the driver's license is not a voter card. I think we discussed that in this committee when we were talking about driver's license for all. And I think that that's what we heard the testifier pretty clearly state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Greenman, are you aware that under current law, while you are renewing your driver's license or actually getting a new driver's license, you can opt in to be registered at that same time?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I am.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll just follow up on that. And it seems to me then that option is already available to people to actually get registered during that time. And I'm just wondering why it was changed to be the other way around.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think based on what we heard from the testimony, this is actually a more efficient and quicker way to do things. So you're already at the DMV, if you're already providing the information you need, that's your address, your age, and that your documentary, that you're a citizen. So people might provide a passport, they might provide naturalization papers or a birth certificate. If they're already providing that information, what this does is transmit that to the Secretary of State for registration. So it actually makes it less onerous for the eligible voter because they're not in the hectic, frantic, often busy system. They're not filling out all that paperwork. They've actually already provided that information, which is then passed on to be checked by the Secretary of State and then passed on to the county so that folks can have the option to decline if they so wish or be registered.
Last follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. But you're talking about registration during the day, during the election day, but here we're talking about a current system that simply, absolutely, the only additional work they have to do from what you suggested, they have to check a box, or they don't check it and it automatically goes in. There's no other change to that. And by checking the box, it gives actually the authority to the individual to decide, whereas the other way that you're suggesting this, they have no decision to make. It's going to be done for them. And so the ability for somebody to choose, check a box, still providing the same information as you suggested, is still there. We'll debate it later, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. Thank you.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as I understand it, this bill moves that checkbox that's on your license application now would be done by a government employee, like when you go to actually hand them your application. They would process it there. Is that accurate?
Representative
Greenman. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative West. I don't think so, because what this does is removes that checkbox. And what it says is if you've provided the information, so you've provided proof of citizenship, your age, and your residence, that's sent, and then you get a card in the mail that says your option to decline. So I think that it moves the opportunity to decline to you getting that postcard in the mail.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the bill it says you'll be registered if your application includes documentation and verifying of United States citizenship. That's 5.24. So if it's automatic, when you go to that government employee to hand them the application that you filled out for your driver's license, if they don't have a box to check, because that's what I understood at talking to some other people, when do you submit that verification of citizenship?
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative West, for letting me clarify. So if you're applying for a non-compliant driver's license, a real ID, or an enhanced driver's license, you may use your passport, your birth certificate, and that proves your citizenship. And if you provide that information along with your residence and age, your information is passed on to the Secretary of State. If you don't provide that information, your information is not passed on to the Secretary of State. I think that that's what the Secretary refers to it as automated, not automatic. So what this does is says the only folks whose information are passed on are the folks who are providing that citizenship as part of the transactions that they are already doing at the DVS.
Okay. Thank you. Representative West, one last one.
So with a non-compliant driver's license, especially with the current law, well, what is expected to be current law, they don't have to prove citizenship for a non-compliant. Obviously, real ID, you do. So when you submit that for a non-compliant license and you use a birth certificate that actually proves citizenship rather than like a utility bill or something else to just prove where you live, is that documentation like scanned in so when they apply for that non-compliant license, even though they don't need to prove citizenship for that, if they do prove citizenship for a non-compliant license, the documentation they provide is scanned in, like physically in some way verified?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Like, right. Is the actual documentation included with that application so those things are connected?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think what you're asking is how the DPS stores what they're getting. What is important is, and that happens, is that the DPS, the DVS verifies that documentation has been provided or in the past has been provided and verified and then sends that information on to the Secretary of State. What the Secretary of State needs to know is, one, that they've shown documentary proof of citizenship, two, that they're of eligible age to vote, and three, their address.
Okay. Thank you. Members, I just wanted to make an announcement here. We have four amendments, and I want to make sure that there's a proper discussion. So room traffic control has indicated that we can have this room till 10:20. I'd rather do that than come back Thursday. So I hope this doesn't inconvenience members that might have other activities here in the next 20 minutes, but I think that will be sufficient time to consider amendments, and hopefully that doesn't interrupt your schedules, but that is, I think, going to be beneficial for all of us. And we might get done before then, but it will be, you know, at the latest 10:20. Okay, Representative Petersburg, your A8 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And A8 amendment actually just eliminates the Section 7, we're talking about this, from the bill for a very important reason, and puts it back to pre-existing, which means you could still register during your application for a driver's license.
I think we need to move it. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, I do move the A8. Amendment, please.
A8 is before us, and continue your testimony.
And ditto from what I said before.
Yes. Okay.
So that it really is important that we have the opportunity for individuals to opt in rather than opt out. And I'm going to tell you a story that's historical, and it's a factual. I think it was in the early 70s, there were unscrupulous companies out there that scammed the American citizens. And I think it was either CD sales or book clubs, in which you were sent a letter or a card saying, hey, congratulations, you are now entered into this book club. And your first month is free, and after that you'll be charged $9 a month or whatever it might be. But if you want to opt out, you need to send this card back in. Well, guess what? Most people didn't do that. They didn't understand it, et cetera. And the courts ruled that that was unlawful. Because you have to give people the opportunity to actually decide whether or not they want to do this particular process. This bill, the way it is written, does exactly the same thing. You take away the individual's discretion on whether or not they want to go in or not until after the fact. And for those that may not understand that or not recognize that, you have to then do something afterwards. Currently, the ability to provide all the information that you say is easy to do during registration for a new driver's license or a renewal can currently be done with the individual only doing one thing, checking a box. I don't think that's too hard or too difficult for them to do. It allows them to still have control and ownership over this. Now, if you don't want that, you have to then provide additional work later, et cetera. Maybe you've already registered, whatever it is. The point is that government is making these decisions now for the individual instead. And I just don't think that's the proper way to do it. Furthermore, the way the bill is written, those that are choosing to go with a regular non-enhanced or non-real ID license, if they don't provide that information, they're not going to be registered. Same thing with people with IDs. They're not going to be registered. So, and they aren't even given an option then to check the box. So this just is kind of a backwards thing to do, and I know other states have done it. That doesn't mean that we should. And so I would recommend this, and Mr. Chair, I would like a roll call on this one.
Thank you. We'll have a roll call. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment would delete automatic voter registration from the bill, and I just want to clarify. This is just talking about registration. People still have the opportunity to decide whether to vote or not. North Dakota does not have voter registration at all. Registration is an administrative act that just makes sure that the rolls are clean, and so I'd ask you to vote against this amendment, eliminating automatic voter registration from the bill.
Thank you. We have a roll call. The author is requesting a no vote. And Mr. Petrie.
Chair Hornstein.
No.
Hornstein, no. Representative Tadke.
No.
Representative Tadke, no. Representative Petersburg.
Yes.
Representative Petersburg, yes. Representative Brand.
No.
Representative Brand, no. Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Elkins, no. Representative Fogelman.
Yes.
Representative Fogelman, yes. Representative Hudella.
Yes.
Representative Hudella, yes. Representative Cagle.
No.
Representative Cagle, no. Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Kraft, no. Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Murphy, yes. Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Nelson, no. Representative Norris.
No.
Representative Norris, no. Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Olson, yes. Representative Sensormira.
No.
Representative Sensormira, no. Representative West.
Yes.
Representative West, yes. And Mr. Chair, we have 6 ayes and 9 noes.
There being 6 ayes and 9 noes, the motion does not prevail. The next amendment is A9, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A9 amendment.
A9 amendment is moved. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with this, this amendment is very similar, except it doesn't, you know, remove it entirely. It creates the opt-in again. This is a privacy issue for me. The idea that when you're pre-registered to vote, then all of a sudden the floodgates open. I know many of us who spent time in some of those battleground districts in the suburbs would knock on doors and someone would answer and say, oh my goodness, more campaign literature. Please stop this, right? And this is taking away an individual's rights to privacy. We all of a sudden see, hey, Joe is now registered to vote. Now I'm going to send him 100 pieces of literature and just bombard him with campaign lit so then he will potentially vote for the candidate that I want. This seems to me like it's arduous. It's completely unnecessary with the idea of having same-day registration. I can literally go in and on a whim with 5 minutes left before the polls close, and I can say, oh, man, I'm going to go vote, and I can register very simply. My wife, just so we could test this, I walked in with my wife. I had pre-registered because I think it's so awesome that I could check that block when I changed my license. I had an address changed a couple years ago. Checked that block, said, man, now I'm ready to go. It was awesome. But my wife didn't do that when she changed her license. We walked in, and I said, this is my wife. I know where she lives. She lives in my house with me. And she got a ticket to vote, and it worked just great. And she legally cast her ballot, and it was just fine. This creates multiple layers of redundancy. when it's not necessary, it becomes arduous. I think I see the way that this is going to go. I think it's going to be voted down. I won't ask for a roll call, but what I would ask is at least have a box that you can check on the application to opt out. You know, if you're going to automatically opt me in, the postcard within 20 days, that is something that's going to get lost in the mail, or it's going to get lost in a stack. I know in my table at home, I've got a stack. It's this thick of mail that I need to get through. And I know that people are going to be – I'm probably not the only human being who has that on my kitchen table, a stack of mail. And once those 20 days go through, now I'm like, oh, no, now 20 days is over, arduous, now I have to go and call or do whatever. Maybe I send it in late. At least have an opt-out box on the application. It wouldn't be hard. It'd be as easy as the opt-in box on that registration. For me, this is entirely privacy-driven. Someone who doesn't want 100 pieces of campaign literature should not be bombarded with 100 pages of campaign literature.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, as Representative Olson says, essentially eliminates automatic voter registration. It turns it back into the system we currently have, but in a little bit more clunky form. And so I would ask you to vote no.
Any further discussion?
I guess I have just one question. Could we add the opt-out checkbox? It would not be hard. It's already an opt-in checkbox. Can't we add an opt-out?
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and Representative Olson. I'm happy to talk to you about it. This is actually the whole way that we designed it is to make it, one, more efficient for voters, more efficient for DPS and the Secretary of State. I will say that the last time I was at the DMV, I waited an hour and a half, and I missed the box because in the franticness of waiting in line, one of the things we're trying to do is actually take this transaction that is about voting in and take it out of the DMV and automate it. I'm happy to have the conversation, but I'm inclined to leave the system the way it is.
Thank you. All those in favor of the Olson A9 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. A10 is Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to move the A10. And this particular amendment basically says if we're going to be using the information that we're going to be collecting for a real ID and enhanced ID, maybe we should just hold off on the effective date of this section until we actually have to do the full compliance, because I think that will make a lot more people actually do the compliance, has a lot more information will be given, and it may be even more efficient for the department, because that's where the efficiency is. It's not for the individual, because that efficiency is still there. And so this just makes sense to me, and I would highly recommend a yes vote. It seems to make sense to me.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would say that this amendment would change the effective date for implementation to the indeterminate timeline of federal Real ID compliance, which is actually not necessary. What is necessary for this bill and for DPS is that when folks come and show their documentary proof of citizenship, their age, their residence, that information can be securely transferred on. The implementation dates are based on what our agencies here have said that they need in order to comply, and Minnesota will be ready based on those implementation dates, not a far away, it's been extended, I think, for 10 years, implementation date of Real ID that is not necessary for the effectiveness of this bill. And I'd ask you to vote no.
Thank you. Discussion or any? Thank you very much. So the Petersburg A10 amendment is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. We have one more amendment, I believe, and that is Representative Olson A11.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A11.
A11 is before us. See?
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the A11 basically just ties it in with the Real ID. I think it probably defeats the point because it's nearly impossible to get your Real ID or your enhanced identification. I went there 3 times and just said, forget about it. My military ID will suffice to get me on a plane. But I think this one makes sense because if we believe that Minnesotans need to feel secure in the knowledge that their airplanes are safe, we should also feel the need to provide Minnesotans the ability to be safe in the security that their government officials are, in fact, who they voted for. So I think this would be a great great addition. It may, in fact, defeat the point due to the impossibility of getting the real ID. That might be a discussion for a later date.
Representative Wilson, we will definitely be talking about real ID in this committee. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson. I think you make the point about why we want to disentangle this from real ID. The important piece is if an eligible Minnesotan comes and shows that they have a passport, a birth certificate, naturalization papers, that's what we need. There are three kinds of IDs, I know, licenses. I know that this committee is very well versed in that. And it doesn't matter if you have a non-compliant license, 60% of Minnesotans do. Most of them are eligible citizens. If you provide the documentation that you need, you should be able to be a part of this program. And so I'd ask you to vote no.
Thank you. Any further discussion of the A11 amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. Okay, members, we now have, I think that is it for amendments. So we have now House File 3 as amended before us, and I will give the author opportunity for any final comments or the committee for any final questions. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I asked of the Department of Public Safety, I said, how many driver's license and IDs out there? And he said, the information I got back is there's approximately 5 million credentials out there, which includes IDs and driver's licenses. And 65% of those are the standard non-compliant. And basically what this bill does is it only automatically registers those that have provided real ID and enhanced ID documentation. And the average person who's going to go and renew their driver's license, if they aren't aware that they have to bring all that stuff in order to be automatically registered, are just not going to get registered. And so we're talking about over half of those that aren't going to be automatically registered. So, and even I think the Secretary of State here talked about only a few hundred thousand people that this would be impacted. This to me, especially when there isn't any way to opt out during the application process, is not only onerous, it is actually imposing government intervention onto the individual. Now we say, well, everybody should want to vote. Absolutely, I think everybody should want to vote. I also think if everybody should want to vote, checking a box saying they want to be registered to vote ought to be the least that we should expect of them in order to acquire that privilege and the right to vote. And so this is something that I just think is not the right place, it's not the right direction, and we should be not voting to move this out or send it back without approval or something. But this is actually just a terrible way of doing business when you're telling the people that you are representing and the people that you oversee, as the government does, hey, we're going to make this more efficient for you because we're going to tell you what to do. It's not more efficient for them because they don't have a choice. So don't say it's efficient for them. And I just think this is the wrong direction to go. It's way overstepment of government intervention. And I highly recommend a no vote.
Okay. Any...
And Mr. Chair, I would also like a roll call.
Okay, I was kind of wondering about that. if there's no more further discussion, we will give Representative Greenman the last word here as the author. Any other discussion? Okay, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the discussion. I think it sounds like we agree that removing barriers to participation, to voter participation, is important, and we're having a conversation about how to do that. What I will say again is voter registration is the administrative act that we take that ensures that we have voter rolls, but it is actually the decision to vote that one, Minnesota has done a really good job of ensuring that we have very high voter turnout. This is my opportunity to brag that I come from the highest voter turnout district in the state, but we have all done a good job of ensuring engaging voters. What this does is say for those folks who registration has been a barrier. It removes that administrative and bureaucratic hurdle by saying if you've already provided all the information that government needs to register for you to vote, you'll have the opportunity to decline, and once you don't take that opportunity, you'll be on the rolls. You can decide whether you want to vote or not. This is, a modernization that has happened in many states because of what we hear from elections administrators, because of what we hear from those folks who do the work in our polling places. I agree that same-day registration is important. It's a crown jewel, as the Secretary said, I think as Representative Olson said, that it is something that is accessible. This would ease the burden at the polling place. It would ensure that folks, that registration is not a barrier, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Thank you for a very good discussion, members, and for the amendment. I will renew my motion that House File 3, as amended, be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. We have a roll call. Mr. Petrie.
Hornstein.
Hornstein votes aye.
Hornstein, aye. Hefke.
Aye.
Hefke, aye. Petersburg.
No.
Petersburg, no. Brand. Brand, aye. Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Fogelman. Udella.
No.
Udella, no. Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Kraft.
Aye.
Kraft, aye. Murphy.
No.
Murphy, no. Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Norris.
Aye.
Norris, aye. Olson.
No.
Olson, no. Sensormira.
Aye.
Sensormira, aye. West.
No.
West, no. And Mr. Chair, we have 9 ayes and 5 nays.
Okay, with 9 ayes and 5 nays, you are on your way to public safety. Thank you, Representative Greenberg. Thank you, members. A couple quick announcements. We are going to be back in 120 on Thursday, so thank you for everyone's indulgence with our meeting today. Our bills on Thursday, we will continue the hearing on House File 246, Jess Hansen. That is the Dan Patch issue. And Representative Brand has a minimum crew size required for rail carriers. And Representative Petersburg.
Mr. Chair, I promised you that I would make this motion that we keep this room for our committee hearing.
Yeah. Okay, a motion has been made. I will lay that over for possible discussion with House leadership. With that, we're adjourned, and we'll see you on Thursday.